This is Karen Brewster, and today is January 3rd, 2020, and I'm here with Ted Birkendahl at his home in Laguna Woods, California. And this is an interview for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park Oral History Project. Ted, thank you for having time today to talk to me.
Thank you for coming and talking to me.
I'm just going to say, for sake of the recording, that you were interviewed previously for the National Park Service before you retired, and that was a good overview of your life and career, and so we're not going to start from birth.
No.
We're going to focus most of this interview on your connections working for the Park Service related to Klondike and some of your regional responsibilities. We'll kind of go back and forth.
Okay.
But just to get us started, a bit of the overview. We've just been talking. I know you were born in Norway.
Yes.
And you came to this country at age 5.
Yes.
And then where did you grow up in the...
Colorado.
Okay.
My mother's sister lived in Colorado and had immigrated much earlier. So I grew up in Colorado Springs.
Okay.
Which was a great place for a kid back then.
Yeah. And when is back then? What time?
I came to the U.S. in 1950.
Okay.
In December of 1951. And we came on the Queen Elizabeth on second class. So we got to be with the sister ship of the Queen Mary.
Uh-huh.
And then we came to New York, and then we moved to California briefly because I had grandparents there who had immigrated in 1910.
Wow.
But we didn't stay in California. We went from Sonoma to Colorado Springs, Colorado, where my mother's sister lived. And I grew up there as an employee's kid with my mother worked for the Broadmoor.
Which was
hotel.
A hotel, okay.
Yeah. And so I grew up in that town, and it was great for kids because you're close to the mountains and could bike there. And
oh, cool.
You could... Back then, the town was only 60,000, and you could bike downtown and do whatever you wanted. So you had nature and city life mm-hmm. combined.
And then you studied archaeology in college?
Yeah, I got enraptured by archaeology at the age of 8 when I read the Golden Book of Archaeology, which was a kid's book.
Mm-hmm. I remember those golden books.
Oh, they were wonderful. Yeah. And that one, I said, you can make money doing this? And then... my family didn't have college education, but I was going to go to University of Colorado, and I thought they would have an archaeology program, which I learned they did. And that's what I wanted to be. It never wavered. And I was really lucky at Colorado because Colorado had a very good program for undergraduates. Super good. We had graduate student mentors. And also they didn't have field schools, you got hired.
Oh.
So you had to compete for the jobs as an undergraduate. And I started when I was 19 at Dinosaur National Monument doing archaeology with the University of Colorado, which was contracted to the Park Service back then. And that was a super experience. I found out I loved it.
Yeah.
And I was somewhat good at it, and I got published as a sophomore with
wow.
Brian Hayden, who is now a major figure in Canadian archaeology and worldwide
wow.
hunter-gatherer studies. So then I got NSF grant then to help carry you over. Plus you get paid at Colorado. You could also get fired.
No. So, sounds like perhaps you got fired?
No,
oh.
Didn't. But I got a nickname of Leroy because I spilled alcohol in a first aid kit and didn't say anything. My mentor, Dave Bretternitz, who was one of the major professors there, he found out and nicknamed me Leroy after that.
Why Leroy?
Just because it was... teasing me. You know, like Leroy is not a very, you know, it's classy name.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And then you went on to graduate school?
Yeah, Colorado, because I got into the Colorado Scholars Program. I wasn't wealthy. I'd caddied since I was 13 to make money to go to school. I had a tuition scholarship from the Broadmoor L. Pomar Foundation. And that covered me because my mother was not wealthy. And
right.
So, and I was totally ignorant of the wider picture of academics. I just wanted to be an archaeologist, and Colorado at that time was ninth in the country in their programs in anthropology.
Mm-hmm.
So I was I got really good experience because I worked every summer with the University of Colorado. I then went to Mesa Verde, and I wrote my dissertation on the Mesa Verde district because I got an NSF for my PhD. So I stayed at Colorado rather than moving on. I looked at the University of Pennsylvania, but I didn't get any money. A friend of mine had gone there, Payson Sheets, who is now a professor emeritus at Colorado, because they took him back. My goal was to be a professor. I was ABD, all but dissertation, and I got a job offer for Guam. And one thing Colorado taught you was to be adaptable. I worked on the plains too.
Mm-hmm.
So I had plains, northwest Colorado, southwest Colorado. I was not like a southwestern archaeologist, and I thought, that'd be great.
Yeah.
So I went to Guam and was there 4 years, and was involved in salvage archaeology on weekends, things like that.
Weren't you teaching there?
Yes, I was an instructor. And I was there 4 years, and I left because I loved the place. It taught me a lot. I got into historic preservation then and was involved in historic preservation planning in the territory with the government. And I was on their historic preservation board as the archaeologist. I was the only archaeologist on the island.
Hmm.
But I turned from doing weekend archaeology to kind of a futile attempt. I had a group there called GASP, Guam Archaeological Salvage Program. And GASP is a good... because I would do it for free when I could, but it took me away from writing my dissertation, which was on the basket makers in Mesa Verde.
Uh-huh.
My wife convinced me wisely, say, you've got to get out of here, you're never going to get it done. Because I was working, I was teaching 5.5 classes.
Wow.
And it was a very small department. I had a great boss who was very tolerant, a great ethnologist, Scott Wilson. But I wasn't making good progress because I was studying and doing all this stuff and involved in everything, and there just wasn't time.
Right.
I had to teach the full range of anthropology.
Oh, right.
Everything from behavioral science with other scholars who were sociologists and things like that, to teaching advanced classes in archaeology for graduate students. We had a master's program.
Wow.
So it was the only college in Guam.
Yeah.
It was mainly, I'm diverting, but then I went back to Colorado and lived in Colorado Springs for a while to write my dissertation on the savings we'd had.
Right. Then how did you get to Anchorage? Or how did you get to Alaska, I guess we should...
Well, there's a circuitous route.
Okay.
Rather quickly, a friend of mine, Bruce Anderson, who was a colleague, said they were looking for people for the National Park Service Indian Assistance Program who are archaeologists, and that was at that time the headquarters of the Park Service in the Southwest was in Santa Fe.
Mm.
So I got that job as a temporary, and then that turned into a permanent job, and then I became head of the program when my boss died. Then I shifted from that because the BIA took that over. We assisted the Hopi and the Navajo with their archaeological programs. And it taught me a lot because I was involved in really big contracts.
Yeah.
Up to $400,000,
wow,
which was a lot back then.
And what year would this have been, time period?
I would have been, that would have been 76 through 82.
Okay.
And that was a great learning experience because I was all over the place and I had a fair amount of responsibility. As that program phased out, we did a phase out with the BIA.
Mm-hmm.
I got transferred to being the chief of the branch of archaeological compliance in the Southwest region. And that was about 1982. And that actually is a preface to what happened there. In those years to 1985 when I came to Alaska, that was December of 85 that I moved to Alaska, and I can explain that. But quickly, we had a problem, and this is still true. The former, one of my employees then, or became the regional archaeologist for Southwest region, and everyone there experienced accumulating loads of writing and responsibility in writing that they couldn't fulfill.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know how to stop that because I didn't have the ability to slow down the demand. We had to deal with compliance archaeology, Section 106 responsibilities, mm-hmm, but we didn't have the time to write it up. And that was really bothersome, and I got myself into a big debt. So did others. And Bruce Anderson himself, who had originally recruited me, he accumulated a lot at El Moro, where he had done work. So this was a pattern, and I tried to push against it, but I couldn't win.
Yeah.
So I had good bosses and stuff. It's just the demands were so high, and we didn't have enough people.
And the compliance archaeology, it has a deadline.
Yes.
Problem. You have to do it before it's going to get destroyed or some
correct
project's going to happen.
So you've got to get out of the ground.
Right.
If you got salvage or what then became data recovery. At first it was salvage archaeology, and then they
right
transformed it under 106 to data recovery if you had something that was actually significant in the path of the construction.
Mm-hmm.
So I sent myself to New Orleans, where I accumulated a big debt working on both Indian things and the Battle of New Orleans. Later on, I was able to discharge that debt. I had a 1,000-page report because I had to redo the geography of the battlefield because it was off by 600 feet.
Wow.
So that took, and I had to do it in the context of compliance.
Wow.
Oh. So anyway, I was in that program, and we did work in the National Park Service in Southwest region, which then extended Louisiana and Arkansas. So we were everything from the northeast Arizona to Louisiana.
Wow, big region.
Yeah, and I signed myself Louisiana because nobody else wanted to go.
It was too humid.
It was terrible weather at times. It was either too hot or too cold.
Yeah.
When I went down for a extended excavation, because we worked for the Corps of Engineers, I was recruited because I'd found a battlefield landmark that shouldn't have been there, and got in trouble with the planners because I ruined a 2-year plan for the park. They told me you had to go down and find this house, and I found the house. It was just where I said it was. And then Then I was recruited by the Corps of Engineers through a cooperative agreement to do their levee work in the park and to see if there was anything in the path. Luckily, there wasn't anything major, but it required me to rebuild the battlefield.
No.
And to make sure that was the case.
Right.
Because the stuff they had was completely goofy.
Yeah, you have to make sure the boundaries are where they say they are, probably.
Correct. I had to re-ground truth the whole thing.
Wow.
And anyway, I got the report out, and I used historians. By the way, Jerry Green, who was a great historian with the Denver Service Center. And he wrote part of that report on his own time.
Wow.
He had to take leave because he was put to a new...
Right.
Anyway, that's... But I loved it there. I didn't have any problem. But that was a problem that was always in my head.
Right.
And my bosses did everything they could to make that not happen. But that's the preface to coming to Alaska, and it has a direct bearing on how I thought about Skagway.
Right.
That's why I want to blabber a little bit.
Right. Well, so you came to Alaska in December of 85, and you were the regional archaeologist for the Park Service?
It was arranged that I would go up there, and I think that's in my exit interview by regional directors, because they were concerned about someone else getting the position.
Right.
And that person was still there, and they rearranged my job, my immediate boss, what's her name? Hart. I'm having a...
Yeah, it's in the other interview. I think you say her name.
Leslie Hart.
Leslie Hart, okay.
Yeah. Well, anyway, she didn't like me being arranged because she hadn't been told. They told her I was coming. And so she gave part of my job to Ken Schoenberg and put him ahead of research. So I had no money. I just had the position. And I had compliance left when I got there. And that was not the agreement.
So the people who set you up to hire you, those, it was at a high regional level, and Leslie was sort of the supervisory person? Okay.
So
they'd gone around her, basically.
Correct. And because she was very close to that person. And he had convinced her he was wonderful. So, taking her to dinner and stuff.
What was that like, showing up to work in Anchorage under those conditions?
Well, I looked forward to Alaska because I was fairly eclectic. I also worked in Norway for 3 months.
Yeah.
At Ullenhall, which was a major Iron Age site. So, anyway, I wasn't wedded to the Southwest, and my goal was to become a regional archaeologist. That was and here was an opportunity.
Right.
I didn't know it was going to be the way it was. I was not informed about the resistance of my future boss. Doug Scoville, the chief archaeologist of the National Park Service, orchestrated it. I was picked because I was considered a good manager. Even though I had failed to do everything to get us doing reports,
right,
or having time to do it, it's just... But I was a good supervisor, and I had up to 9 people working for me.
Was there any reason in particular you wanted to come to Alaska?
I wanted to be a regional archaeologist, and it was an opportunity. I thought it was exciting. I thought, oh boy, yeah. I was a little bit with trepidation, and I said, I was thinking, I wonder if they have much to find. Because, you know, it's I'd studied a little bit of Arctic and subarctic archaeology in Colorado, but it was just an overview. But I was a little concerned, what are we going to really find here? I didn't know enough to know better.
Mm-hmm.
But I was excited to come because I thought it was a fresh territory and I would have a new job. So I arrived there, and then it had been rearranged on me. So I only had compliance and the title. And I had 2 employees, one of which I didn't even know I had. because Bob Spoody, who is Kathy Spoody's mm-hmm. husband today, didn't tell me. He told me I'm the technical supervisor, but he was the real supervisor.
And he was regional historian at that time?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so I came into that, and Ken Schoenberg was in charge of research and had all the money, and I had just compliance money at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no real budget other than myself, and Paul Gleason was my main employee. 6 months later, I learned that Susan Morton, who worked with the public archaeology programs, that she worked for me. And the way I found that out is Bob Spoody handed me the phone and said, there's someone you got to talk to. And it was an angry pilot, because Susan Morton had not shown up for the flight to Kayak Island.
Oh.
And I forget why. There was a reason, and it had been canceled, but he
didn't get the message.
There was some, yeah. And he was yelling and screaming, and that's when I found out that Susan Morton worked for me.
And then your predecessor was Craig Davis?
Yes.
So, was he still there when you
no.
came?
He had gone on a hardship to Washington. There was, back then, FTE was very, very, it was precious. Reagan had instituted that FTE would be the way to control the budget.
So FTE, full-time employment positions.
Those positions were impossible. So my FTE was traded to Washington, so Craig Davis could get a position there under a hardship. His two children were sick, and he needed better medical care than was offered in Anchorage at that time. So that left... The person who was going to succeed him, or thought he was, mm-hmm. was Ken.
Schoenberg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that didn't happen, and Leslie didn't have the power to do that.
So did Craig leave you any information, or
no.
did you get any training or anything?
No. I went cold.
And you went cold into an environment where some people didn't really want you there,
correct.
It sounds like.
Yes.
Wow, it sounds tough.
So, it was, I could have, if I'd been smarter, I could have protested, but it was like, I was told that she had made that decision, and the regional director, Boyd Evison, didn't make a change at that time. So, I got up there and made do the best I could. I was used to compliance, and then I would get rangers coming from Seward and saying, when is my report going to be published? And I actually didn't have any money for that project. It was a project that Craig had initiated, and he promised a report. So on a historic cabin down at Kenai Fjords mm-hmm. National Park. And I actually begged, I had a connection to Georgia. And I can't remember how I got it, but it's with a guy, a National Park Service publisher there for the Park Service. And I convinced him, I had a little seed money somewhere, I forget where I got it. But I said, we got to publish this, can you do it? And he did it.
Wow.
And I got the report done, and it was published. You know, in a limited
right.
number, but at least I got it done. Anyway, that yeah. was, so I'm there, whew, let's see, I'm there sometime just before Christmas in December, and then later on I go to Klondike for reconnaissance.
So that was the Mascot Saloon?
Yes, and that was...
And that was in when?
That was in
February of 86, right?
Yes.
Oh, so you hadn't even been there very long.
Nope. And Paul Gleason, who is my compliance archaeologist under me,
mm-hmm.
and I went down there to scout it out and meet with Kathy Blee, who then became Kathy Spoody.
Okay.
And this is where that my blabbing connects up. I was adamant that we didn't get accumulating debts in compliance.
Mm-hmm.
And Skagway was my first step to do that. And so Paul and I met with Kathy, and one thing we were really concerned about is Kathy believed only got maybe 2 weeks of excavation. Like, she worked at the depot.
Mm-hmm.
She got to dig a few test pits. Now, she did marvelous work with that, and she really interpreted stuff. I mean, she did great interpretation of the material
right.
she had to her, what limited material she could accumulate. Because they would, Denver Research Center was doing the archaeology, and they would say where she worked.
The Denver Service Center.
Yes.
Right.
They would say, you got 2 weeks, or you got, and it was just, it's the same thing we were plagued with. But they would constrict the amount of work that could be done artificially, just saying you got a limit.
Why? Because they needed to get the work done on the building?
Yes. They wanted her out of there so they could start doing the architectural rehabilitation.
I wonder if the seasonality in Alaska also crunched the time.
Maybe not
in Skagway.
No. You can work there even into the fall, and maybe winter is pretty doggone hard, but Paul went down there even in the winter. So we met with Kathy and talked to her and said, we'd like you to get your reports done because you're getting behind. Even with the short field seasons that she was getting, she wasn't getting enough time to finish things. So we thought, this is not good. Paul was a similar thinker to me, and he was a great archaeologist. He was one of the best field archaeologists ever. He's up in the Seattle area, Port Angeles, today. He worked for, what's the peninsula?
Olympic Peninsula.
Yeah. So we were of like mind. And so with the Skagway thing, what we did was we wanted to do the, with Kathy, we went and crawled underneath the Mascot Saloon through underneath the thing, and we went, oh my God, there are peanuts under here, peanut shells, there was all kinds of debris and broken glass. We said, gee, this is like, you know, King Tut's tomb for Skagway.
Right.
We knew it hadn't been bothered, or we thought it, we were on the assumption that it hadn't been altered. It was the direct primary deposit material, as opposed to secondary. Kathy disagrees, by the way.
Well, we're going to talk about that.
But
about the findings.
Yeah, and there's a report I did for the Park Service on that once I had retired.
Yeah, you sent me a copy.
Oh, good.
Yeah, that's
anyway,
why we'll talk about it.
But so we were crawling around under there. This is February. It's cold.
And the Mascot was the next building in line for restoration, so that's
correct.
Why you guys went there.
Yes, and they had a tight timeline. And it ironically took the longest to get that report done. So anyhow, they put a timeline on us for getting it done before June. So that put the burden, I asked, well, Paul was my single compliance archaeologist and he hired temporaries, and he planned it out. He knew what he was going to do. He did a good job. And he spent, I think, at least a month down there with the crew. And Carl Gerke was part of that crew, who became the cultural resource person for the park.
Right.
At that time, he was hired as a historian, but not at that time as a mascot. It was just after.
Right. Carl started doing archaeology at the park.
Yes, he did.
Kind of.
But he got hired as a historian and then did the archaeology.
Right.
And later he became the archaeologist. But Carl was part of the crew. And Paul did a great job, invented a conveyor belt method of getting stuff out of the crawl space under the present day mascot.
Yeah, so I was thinking, like, how do you do archaeology under the floorboards of a building?
With great difficulty. If you look at the report, you can see them squashed in.
Yeah.
It's only like 4 feet.
Yeah, and dark.
Yes, I mean, it is. They had lights.
You had to bring lights in. And
so it's like cave archaeology under there.
Yeah.
And they all look like troglodytes if you look at the picture. And that, so Paul got that out of the ground and did a marvelous job. It was very tight archaeology.
Yeah.
Got that stuff done by the deadline. And he had exhausted every possible way, avenue to get that done and done right.
And so to get it done and done right, does that mean they took out every single artifact, or they just survey it and leave things there, or how does that work?
There was if I recall correctly, they did a full data recovery, which means you don't do everything, but they did a large number of the grids. They laid out grids underneath the mm-hmm. building, and Paul was a good technician in terms of doing things, and I think they dug almost half of it out. What they did is sampled it, because mm-hmm. normally under data recovery, you don't dig everything unless you're exhausted, you want to leave something behind.
Mm-hmm.
Most of it was, there were some plots left, I think they're still underneath they're gone, because they put in the utility works under there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know from looking at the archaeology reports, it says Area 1, Area 2.
Yeah. Yeah, they had different areas and then grids within them. And they sampled everything that was going to be affected. And it was more than a sample. It was a good effort to make the maximum use with getting the data out.
Yeah, because then you don't pick up every wood chip and every fragment of glass.
And you don't dig every grid. So, but they did a good number, and I don't have the map in my head,
right.
it was meant to be a full data recovery program that would not be shameful.
Mm-hmm. And now, did Kathy work on the excavation?
She did not. She was working on her reports that she had backlogged.
Mm-hmm.
That was the whole idea. When we met with her in Skagway in February, she cried because we said, we're going to put you to finishing this. We're not excluding you from working here, but we need you to finish that work because you don't want to be like Southwest Region.
Right.
And already you're accumulating stuff and it's going to become impossible for you to catch up. So we would like you to spend your time doing that for DSC, and Paul will take over in Skagway. So Paul became the main mm-hmm. guy at that time.
And then you said she cried when she was happy, or she
no,
was...
she was unhappy.
She did not want to leave
well,
the
field.
Well,
she was very wedded to Klondike.
Yeah.
She loved it. We had nothing against her.
Right.
We just thought that because of... Well, Paul's background was not the same as me, but as an archaeologist, he knew things would sometimes not get done.
Right.
If the money ran out. And... because he had just joined the Park Service in Alaska. So anyway,
Well, I was also thinking, archaeologists tend not to become field archaeologists if they want, you know, that maybe Kathy wanted to do the field work.
Yes, she did.
She didn't want to sit in an office and write a report.
That's
not why archaeologists become archaeologists, I guess.
But she loved doing the work there, and she was good at writing the reports, but she just didn't have the time.
Right.
DSC, just like Jerome Green when he worked for me from DSC, I'd gotten him $3,000 to help me write the history of the Battle of New Orleans, to help me orient, because I knew that I had to have a historical help in New Orleans to do the archaeology. I couldn't do it without a historical
right.
context.
Right, and Klondike is very much like that.
Yes, it is exactly. So anyhow, it had nothing against Kathy. It was about getting a better pace on write-ups after this compliance archaeology mm-hmm. and giving her a breather. So Paul was in a better position to do that. He hadn't accumulated a debt yet.
Mm-hmm.
The irony was they promised to support the writing of the report. And Kathy Blee is the one who ended up writing that report, I think in the 90s?
Yeah.
Because Carl Gerke was then had become the the archaeologist for the park, and he worked with Clay Alderson to get DSC to get the money, which they had promised years before, it's like a decade before, for the Mascot write-up. And Clay was persistent, and there's a funny story I can get back to about that, because I would have never thought he would be the advocate, but he became the advocate for that and did a great job in getting DSC to cough up the dollars for Kathy Blee to complete a report. Larb report that Paul Gleason had done the field work, and then she ended up doing the write-up.
That must be hard to do the write-up on somebody else's field work.
Yeah, but they had good notes and everything, and she did a great job.
Yeah, I know there's like a 10-volume set or something of all the reports from Klondike, and I think they're all by her.
Yeah. So we never excluded her. We wanted her to shine, which she did. So she, there was a big fight for that, and we kept persisting because we said you betrayed us. We got that stuff out of there in time for you to do the rehabilitation, and you didn't fulfill the promise.
Right.
It's bad faith. And Clay used that to finally shame them. He was the one who was brokering it, not me. I was supporting him, and so was Carl. And Carl was very instrumental in convincing him how important this was, because we felt betrayed, because the very thing we were trying to avoid had happened.
Right.
Which was irritating.
And we should say Clay Alderson was superintendent at Klondike at the time.
Correct.
Right. Now, what's the funny story?
Oh. Well, years before that report finally came out and got done, and so Paul Gleason was, we would get the compliance money coming to Alaska. DSC would allocate us what we needed. Frank Willis was the main cultural resource distributor out of DSC, and Kathy worked for him. And she also worked in other parks when there was DSC involved. So she wasn't just exclusive to Klondike. She had other, that was the other thing, she had other responsibilities and duties. Being the archaeological compliance person for DSC. I think for the western parts of western U.S., including Alaska.
Yeah.
So she was initially unhappy, but I think she was fine. And we were getting our opportunities to do stuff.
Right.
So Paul was my compliance archaeologist, and then we continued to press for adequate data recovery when it was necessary for rehabilitation. And I think it was one of the lots, and I can't tell you which one, but it didn't have any buildings on it, but they were going to do stuff there. And Clay, if I remember correctly, didn't want to do anything. There was some timeline problem. Mm-hmm. But you can't, again, this timeline thing with, so he was saying, oh, I don't want to do this. You guys are going to delay the project. The rehabilitation can't happen, blah, 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 blah. It was some utilities and stuff. But it was, according to Carl, it was a very important area of Skagway history in there. So, or historical archaeology. Mm-hmm. So it was initially Paul Gleason dealt with it, and then it got raised, and I ended up dealing with it. And I forget if I was then the chief of cultural resources. I think I was by that time. But the funny, I guess the funny is that Clay became a big advocate for archaeology, but at that time he was not. Mm-hmm. He saw it as an imposition. You know, superintendent wants to do what they want to do, which is a common Park Service thing. They they have trouble with 106. It's like, why are you making it so hard for me? So anyway, Paul Hartel was my boss. He was the associate regional director for planning and culture resources. Mm-hmm. So he had natural and cultural. And he'd been the one who hired me as, by that time Leslie Hart had gone on to other things. Eventually went to Lyndon Johnson's park, and I forget what, LBJ, whatever they call it.
I don't know.
Anyway, she had gone left for first Washington, where she was a congressional liaison for the Park Service. And I was acting, and then I was picked by Paul Hartel to be the permanent.
So that was the head of cultural resources for all of the Alaska region?
Correct.
Okay.
And so Clay and I got into it, and it needed to be resolved at a higher level. And Paul Hartel, in those days, the region wasn't as nervous about telling superintendents what to do. It kind of transformed it a little after that. But Paul Hartel was... some of the superintendents found him a little dictatorial, but he was great to me. But when they were screwing up, he would let them know, and he wouldn't tolerate it. And he had powers, and that power of the associates kind of dissipated over the years as the Park Service became a little less centralized, where the regional director didn't allocate power to the associates as much. He retained that himself, and they were not delegated the authority Paul had at that time. Paul could basically veto a superintendent.
Hmm. And so that's what he did with Clay?
Yeah, we met in his office, and I remember that. And Clay kept saying, "You have to say yes," meaning we're not going to look at that piece of property. We had to do tests in it. That's what the big thing was. We don't know what's there. Carl Gerke said it was, we got to check it out. We can't just go, it's fine.
Okay. Yeah, isn't that the law? If it's federal purchase land, you have to check it?
You are correct. If you're going to have a land modification project on there, and relative to what you're doing, are there significant historic properties or archaeological properties? And yes, that's... So one thing I learned in the Southwest region is always stay with public policy.
Yeah.
Because I'd gotten in a big fight with with a coal company that was working on Navajo land, and they tried to make a survey that had been done in the 1960s, we call a windshield survey, where you drive through the territory. And I knew the guy who did it, who was a good archaeologist, Stu Peckham, but it was nothing. It was just a recon, and it was raining. And I said, you can't have... there's no way the BIA can approve, along with the tribe, this mine, without you doing adequate survey. Well, that guy was very close to Reagan. And all hell broke out. And I just wanted that. We laid up a program that would, for $70,000, they could get the work done. It was maybe double what it is today. But it wasn't a big, horrible job.
Right.
So they even recruited archaeologists from outside the Park Service and outside the BIA as contractors to counter that. So I stuck to my gun. I had delegated, this is really weird in the Park Service, but they had delegated me the power of the regional director.
Uh-huh.
I didn't have to ask him.
Wow. That seems not Park Service at all.
No, it's not. But they didn't want to mess with the Indian Assistance Program. Uh-huh. They didn't, it was like, go do that. My boss, before he passed away, had the same authority. So he had a written authority of the regional director. So I could speak for the regional director. And only we would then alert them of problems. And when I got into the mainline Park Service, that wasn't the case.
Right.
But I had that authority, so I went to the mattresses, so to speak, on this thing. Because this guy didn't want to do it on a matter of principle. He didn't believe in regulations. The head of Sun Century was an energy company.
Yeah.
But it was close to Reagan kind of...
Right. But with Clay, it was more just the time frame.
Well, I'll just finish that story. Okay. The reason is that the regional solicitor had to come into my defense. They wanted me fired. And that can happen.
Yeah.
But I stayed with public policy, and he was able to defend me because everything I was saying was in public policy.
Right.
There was nothing weird.
Right. And
it wasn't exaggerated. I wasn't asking for the moon.
Right. It wasn't your opinion. You were citing published
policy. Correct. And I had given him a really good price that would take the contractor to get that work done at an adequate level to allow us to give him... get him in compliance.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to the company, I said, you're never going to mine because the Navajo tribe's going to kick up your royalties whenever you wanted to. They never mined because the Navajo did what I said, and they said, you haven't done adequate work.
Right.
And by that time, we had gotten the Navajo archaeological program, the indigenous one, going along with Zuni. They had good programs. And we contracted with them and on projects that I was involved in, and they did a good job. Dave Doyle built that program, but it got to be where now today it's indigenous people running.
That's great.
But it was the public policy thing that I wanted to get to.
Right.
So I was adamant. And so Paul Hartel listened to this argument. Clay says, you got to say yes. And I said, I can't say yes. And Hartel sided with me. And Clay went, okay. Because he was told he had to do it. Paul and Carl were involved in that. And I forget the details. I'd have to look at Becky's book.
Was it the property where they ended up building the maintenance building? That's the one I could think of that was an empty lot. And then Doreen Cooper did a lot of the archaeology.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was that lot.
And that was going, and we also had a fuss and fight about another building. It's the old department store there. And I'm not that much of a Skagway expert.
The Lynch and Kennedy building?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And that kind of broke the camel's back in my memory of Clay just saying, yep, we'll get it done. And Carl did a good job kind of getting him into the fold. So the crazy thing is, the guy who was just, I remember sitting in the office, he says, you say yes. And I said, I can't say yes for the same reason that I have to stay within if you leave public policy, you're vulnerable. Now, at least you take the fall.
Right.
Basically, if you do what they say, you take the fall. They don't take the fall.
Right.
And that's where it comes. So they can't outright, they got to find something else to fire you for.
Right.
And my regional director at that time supported me too, because it went up. That was big politics.
And that was Boyd Evison at that time?
No, that was not the... I think it was Bob Kerr in Southwest Region.
Your Southwest one.
So, the regional director was... it may have been Boyd still.
No, when you were...
It was still OSPA, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, early 90s. And so, I think the OSPA was 92...
No, it was 89.
89. Okay, I'm wrong.
Yeah.
I'm losing my...
Yeah, it was 89.
It was around in there.
Yeah, okay.
So it would have been Boyd still there because he got outed for the oil spill.
Because
he responded properly. And they trumped up a deal on him for publishing his memoirs of the oil spill.
Wow.
They said that was illegal. That was an obscure interior rule. That they had to approve controversial things, and they said, well, that was controversial, therefore you're going to Denver.
Hmm. Well, they didn't just fire him, though. They at least transferred him.
That's what they do.
I know, but...
So the Park Service moves everybody somewhere.
Right.
And that's what the government does today, too, if they want to get rid of you.
They move you.
To a place you don't want to go. But the great thing, things improved greatly, and... I gotta say Clay Alderson was a key part of that. I don't know what Carl thinks, but that was from my perspective. And Paul was continued to be the main force to driving the archaeology along with Carl.
Mm-hmm.
And Skagway, then we got things published. Things started to happen. DSC started to listen, I think in part because Paul Hartel and Clay Alderson stayed true,
mm-hmm.
and stood with public policy on Section 106. And we were then very happy because things were coming out one way or another in terms of reports. Where this is where I wanted to be. I made a big point of not getting involved in digging. Craig had loved to do work in Denali. Coming from my background, and already carrying a huge debt of backlog reports from the Southwest region, I didn't want to accumulate anything more.
Right. So you chose not to do field work.
I did field work, but only recon.
Okay.
So I would go to Skagway to do recon or make an argument or make a case, and every now and then I'd go down with Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd look at the buildings and the ground, starting with the mascot. And but I didn't want to get involved in doing any digging because that would mean I had responsibility and that was not where I wanted to be. That was my experience as a regional archaeologist. I don't want to accumulate debt. I have debt.
Right.
I have grinding debt. I don't need more. So what I would like to do is get things going and get them under control. And this was easier once I became the team manager for they changed the name from division chief to team manager for cultural resources. And the other thing that I was very interested in, along with Sid Martin, who was the cultural resource person for
Gates.
She and I became collaborators on CRAC, the Cultural Resource Advisory Council, which was all I had a big fight, and this relates to Skagway, in a sense, is one of the parks, because mm-hmm. Carl gets funding after this, and he got, the whole idea was, I got a regional archaeologist called Gary Summers, who was, I had hired from Hawaii, of all places, but he'd been in the Indian Assistance Program in California and Arizona, similar to my background. He had a similar background, but his outlook was similar to mine. And he had done some work in Hawaii where he had gotten archaeologists in the parks. This was seen as a great accomplishment to get people at the park level who are archaeologists and historians and things like that.
Versus the archaeological assistance coming from regional.
Correct. We wanted to have spokespeople there, people who could do things. And that was starting to happen in Western region where Stephanie Toothman was too, who also had a similar thing. Yeah, Jim Thompson was her regional archaeologist, and he was very open to that. So this was happening, and we communicated. There was a cultural resource group that used to meet throughout the West who had, there were curators and archaeologists, and we would share solutions that we had or problems. And Kathy Blee was a big part of that, and Frank Willis, coming in from the Denver Service Center to meet with all of us. And we would talk about best practices.
Mm-hmm.
And this was so anyway, Sid Martin and I, because she was a park level person, said, let's see if we can get this organized, because there had been a resource management team that was built up of the resource managers in the parks who were largely natural. Almost none of them were cultural resource people, and they had tried to recruit me into being a member of that group. And I said, no, I need my own, we need our own group of park representatives. And we were then working to populate the parks. We'd already started to populate the park with archaeologists and historians where we could. Carl was one of the first.
Right.
And we liked that, because there you got a guy who can talk to Clay or whoever the superintendent.
Well, and they become an expert on the cultural resources in their area.
Correct.
Versus regional, you're doing everything.
Correct. And I truly didn't want the power. I wanted it. I'm weird that way. And Sid was of like mind.
Mm-hmm.
So we wrote up the first kind of constitution or guidelines for the CRAC. And back to where I refused. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And they said, you've got to come to the meeting. I said, I'm not coming to the meeting. It's really weird. It's like I was the reluctant bridegroom. And I was sitting in the office, and Russ Gallipo, who was head of that resource group and became superintendent here of the Channel Islands, he comes in to me and says, you've got to come. I said, I'm not coming. We need our own group. You can't properly represent us if I'm just sitting there by myself with a bunch of natural resource guys. Do you follow it?
Yeah.
I have almost no influence. They're going to override
me. Right.
And I'm going to short deal. So anyway, I'm getting research money. At that time, before that happened, this is probably around 92, we dispersed the money. My branch chiefs and like been Gleason and others, and was Bob Scudi had left by then? I can't, but he would have been involved in the disbursement before he left, and along with my historical architect. And then I got an ethnologist, and they would say, we get Washington money. By that, I'll get back to that. But anyway, the key point here is this got money allocated to a group. By me sitting there and refusing, I may have been Paul Hartel who was there still. He was a great open mind. But what we got was this Cultural Resource Advisory Council made up of all the then park people plus resource managers if they didn't have it. So we invited them to join. They could join in. Whoever the superintendent appointed could join in on that. And we now, rather than our regional office allocating research money and deciding things, put that to the parks.
So did the CREC committee allocate the money?
Yes. We were the advisory, and then it was not rubber stamped, but generally they did the superintendents who had their own council would then agree. I would be a spokesperson or Sid or park people for the projects and the allocation of that money among the parks.
So did the parks have ideas for projects and they proposed it to CRAC?
Yes.
For funding?
That's how it worked.
And then CRAC would decide
Yes. Who
got what?
And yeah. And once initially we had a scoring system, but after a while we decided no, we have to work with the parks and their need.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes parks were not good advocates for their own future. Some of the cultural people, like I had to defend Gene Griffin in Sitka. There was a big fight there between some of the park people and him because he had not made a good case for the survey of Sitka and hadn't explained why it was going to be so costly. rainforest. Yeah. It's horribly hard archaeology. It's elusive as heck. Right. And it costs you, you have to do a lot of testing. And the, we eventually got to Denver's, the Midwest Archaeological Center to do the work because they had really good expertise and technology, which they applied, going, you know, the remote sensing initially.
So if the cultural resource person in a park wants to do a project, they have to get it approved by their superintendent,
yes,
who then forwards it to CREC.
Correct.
So the individual archaeologist.
Then the superintendents, as a council, with the regional directors and the associate directors, approve the our recommendation.
Right.
So that's why we're advisory. We could not effectively do this on our own, but we recommend it. They rarely.
I was going to say, did they ever override any of your recommendations?
No. It wasn't mine.
Right.
By the way, we set it up that I had the same vote as a park.
Mm-hmm. Even though you were regional.
Yeah. Now my staff could come in and advise, like Rachel Mason or Don Calloway,
right,
who's, or Tim Cochran, who really started the program in ethnology in the region. He was great. Because he was a really good salesman of anthropology. And he started on Glacier Bay and did a great job in getting them to completely reverse themselves on the Tlingit.
Hmm.
And I can't remember if he did work. He did some work on Skagway, too, because we wanted to have the tribe involved there, too. Because there is, at Dyea, there's remains of their camps and
right,
stuff like that. Anyhow, but that gave Skagway a voice from the park level, and we also listened to them in terms of compliance, and that they began to allocate, parks also got their compliance money. So they would have to come up with the program.
So compliance money went directly to parks? It didn't go to regional and then you
allocated? Yeah, we moved it out except where we had a job to do. And then basically we would get the money from the park. Like the most difficult job is historical architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And after David Snow left, who did a good job, then Steve Peterson became the really driving force, and then Grant Crosby was allocated, kind of asked by Steve to take over Skagway, and did a super job. The park was really receptive, of course, to historical architecture and
right,
getting the rehabilitation of the buildings, and Skagway did a super job. I mean, you look at those buildings, and they're wonderful.
Yeah.
And
it's amazing to look and think, how does anybody ever figure out that this is what they used to look like?
Well, Steve and Grant would do top research on paint.
And, I know.
And they did the same with Kennecott, which is another. But they look at that whole thing. Now, that's the hardest thing for a park to have. So they came to us for historic architecture, and they came to us for ethnology, but less and less for archaeology. And they also came to us for history, and Sandy will fill you in on that.
Mm-hmm.
And she did a magnificent job because she was also supportive of our concept. All my staff was.
Mm-hmm.
But historical architects are really hard to find.
Right.
That are good and know what they're doing. And can do the work.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering is how a project is a park project versus a regional project.
Generally, it's through CREC, once we got that, it used to be we just said what happened because there wasn't anybody out there. But once we started to get people in the parks, Sid was one of the early ones. I think the earliest is Carl.
Yeah.
And then there was and I would even move money. And I can't remember with Carl if I moved money sometimes that I had. I gave like Gene Schaaf's job at Katmai and Lake Clark We negotiated, Gary Summers and I, my regional archaeologist at the time, negotiated with Frank Pierce, the superintendent at that time of Lake and Katmai. Here, we give you the money out of our own budget for that position. If you hire an archaeologist, mm-hmm. We're going to take the body and give it to you.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to that extreme because we knew it was the good thing to do. And Jean became one of the best Alaskan archaeologists ever.
Right.
She was working for me, but we traded her to.
Oh, I see.
And that was when we were under pressure from the government. Again, went into constriction, and regional offices were supposed to shed people.
Mm.
And that gave us an opportunity to do it. We didn't mind shedding. We just didn't want them to take, there was nothing out there. But the whole idea was to populate the parks of Alaska with archaeologists like Wayne Howell and others.
Yeah, but not every park
needed.
Got an archaeologist or a historian.
They sometimes got something else. Mm-hmm. It's whatever they chose.
Oh, okay.
And then some were more delayed than others. But Skagway was an early cooperator, and I think Clay is to be commended. Mike Turnell did great too.
Mm-hmm.
And Teresa Thibault eventually became the lead person for cultural there. And
right.
I think she did a good job. That's my perspective. We got along really well. And I like the whole idea of hiring Gary Summers as regional archaeologist. Was to do that because he had successfully accomplished it in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't, regions that try to hold on to the power, that they lost with the parks.
Mm-hmm.
With Carl there and others like Teresa, we had spokespeople. Now with historical architecture, they generally had no, they liked it when it came.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have to fight them as much on that. And there was no way to get expertise at that level, even in Skagway. Today, I think they have one.
A historical architect? Well, the person who is head of resources comes from a historical architectural background.
Well, that's perfect.
But Grant is still at the regional office and assists.
Because that's
I don't think she's really doing historical architecture because she's head of resources. So I don't know if she has time.
Yeah, well, that was the problem. So in terms of Skagway, and I let Steve, the other thing I'm, as a supervisor, my job is to make my people successful. And you have people like Steve Peterson who got along really well with the maintenance people.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the money for architecture comes out of maintenance because we allocate that money and their council is the one that allocates the money.
Oh, so historic archaeology doesn't fall under cultural resources.
No.
Historical architecture.
It did. But we worked with the maintenance guys because we would put the money together. Steve was the concept behind that.
Hmm.
And if are you planning ever to interview him? He's in Prescott now.
No, this is the last of the interviews for now anyway.
Anyway, he's got that in his head.
Yeah.
And he did, I was...
Well, as you, that was sort of one of my questions, was you had been regional archaeologist, and then you moved into this regional head of
team
cultural resources, and yeah, how did that shift your responsibilities?
It made me in charge of ethnology, history, historical architecture, archaeology. I had the whole ball of wax, and then I had to think big. I had to think, balance what was going on, but I wanted strong people like Sandy, you know, she was a great regional historian. She didn't do history either much. She did the management of it, and it was the brains behind getting it done.
And so, yeah, becoming head of cultural resources, you became much more say, managerial, and everybody else was out sort of doing the work, whereas when you started as regional archaeologist, you were still kind of more hands-on?
Correct. And then as a regional archaeologist, I did a lot of recon work, like up in Gates of the Arctic, and then I would try to get the work done.
Right.
But my job was not to, mine was to be the advocate, to figure out what should be done, and then to advocate for it.
Right. And so in head of cultural resources, you did the same, but for all those other history, ethnology, and archaeology.
Yeah.
So and when did you make the shift?
89 was, I was acting, and by 91, I was finally hired permanently, and it was Paul Hartel. And I became, so for 2 years I acted, and then I got the job in 91, which I held to the end.
So 2012 is when you retired? So was there a particular reason why you chose to make that shift?
Oh yeah, I remember why. I actually, Leslie Hart had gone off to from first as a congressional liaison, so it was a temporary assignment. She, by that time, I had gained her confidence. And in fact, Ken Schoenberg was caught in her office. He was caught in Gleason's office, too. He'd spy on things.
Oh.
He was awful.
Yeah.
He was an awful supervisor. Well, after she caught him, and Bill Brown and I had gone and seen her and said, you got to get, this guy is not working out. He's an autocrat to his employees. He doesn't work. He's lazy, blah, blah, blah. Because I didn't hire him.
Right.
Leslie had hired him. And then given him that because of a... But finally she had enough when he went up to Richard Stenmark and said, Leslie looks a little stressed. I'm concerned about her. That was a deputy regional director. And Stenmark was a good guy. And he told Leslie. Then she caught him in her office because he was always paranoid, looking at her papers.
Mm.
And then she gave him to me. And I think that was 88 or 89. And then I broke him from supervision. I couldn't get rid of him because that's the government. It's really hard.
Right.
I tried later, and I went all the way to the regional solicitor, and I lost.
Mm.
But I eventually took 6 months to break him with supervision through HR. And then I got him isolated and he just became an archaeologist who I had to...
You still had to manage, but it was less troublesome. Perhaps.
Well, yeah, he wasn't causing chaos and messing around and not... Like, that's why Becky Salibi comes... Well, she did a great piece of work on
that 20 Skagway. Years of his archaeology in Skagway.
Yeah, yeah. That was, she was a master of doing stuff like that. And Susan Bender and her did the plan for Denali, which Ken was supposed to do, his archaeological survey plan. And he just diddled around and didn't do anything, and I had to dump it on them. And they did a great job of mapping out where the priorities should be. And she was a great employee. She worked in the public, she took over Susan Morton's public archaeology role. But I pulled her into the park to help out, and then we got that wonderful project to summarize the archaeology, and she did a magnificent job.
Right.
But
so you became the head of cultural resources. You said you had a reason why you decided
to take
that position.
You gotta get me.
I'm bringing us back.
I had met my goal to be a regional archaeologist. I had authority over all the programs.
Mm-hmm.
I'd broken Ken from his control, and I had the research money in my hands. So, and Leslie had found confidence in me.
Mm-hmm.
She knew that I was a straight shooter and I was a good supervisor. I liked to empower my employees,
mm-hmm.
unless they were idiots. And then I worried. I said, I don't want to work for an idiot. Anybody could get in there because it's national competition. And I thought, I'm going to apply for this. And I think Paul Hartel had encouraged me to apply. He was a very important boss to me in Alaska. And he credited for helping with the archaeological programs and getting cultural programs going. He was a natural, he was a rescue ranger. The highest ranking kind of ranger in the informal network. Interpretive rangers have no status.
Right.
But law enforcement rangers, and then especially rescue rangers, that's what I call them, that's just my term, for the guys who climb mountains and do, you know, really challenging things.
Yeah.
Ralph Tingey was my boss after Hartel, and Ralph was a rescue ranger too, and a great mountain climber and a noted guy. He was wonderful too. So I had some good bosses and that support. Anyhow, I didn't want to work for an idiot, and I said, I'm going to apply. And Paul picked me. And I liked, the minute I got into it, I minored in history, so history interested me, I liked that. I found historical architecture, I didn't know anything much about it, but I appreciated it a lot, and I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it intrigued me. I loved ethnology, because my Colorado training, up to your master's, you can't specialize. You've got to get linguistics, physical anthropology. That's why I could teach on Guam. I taught all those things. Not linguistics. I'm bad at that. But I taught cultural anthropology. I taught physical anthropology and archaeology of the Pacific and all that stuff. And I had Siapi students, and I had Guamanian students and Chamorros. Anyway. So I was pretty open to, once I said, I don't want to work for an idiot, and then I got the job, I found I naturally fit into it. This is at least how I felt. And because I was fascinated by history, I enjoyed like history of the Klondike.
Mm-hmm.
As much as I did ancient archaeology. And I loved, I thought ethnology, that was very important to me, and I fought to get Tim Hockin fired, and I had my own money fraud. I didn't get it allocated by Washington, which was the case in every other region. And Muriel Cresby, who was the chief anthropologist, tried to dictate who you'd hire. And I liked Tim. He was a good salesman of anthropology. She was not. I needed someone to sell it. And I got him, and I found all that good. And I found managing was fun, too, because my joy was the success of other people. I sound like I'm bragging, but
no.
I enjoyed seeing them succeed.
Yeah.
Including the parks succeed, and people like Gene succeeding, and Carl and others. We're doing stuff, and we're doing good work. And we were publishing. We had a good publishing program. I was very proud of that. And that included the Skagway stuff.
Right. All of Kathy's reports.
Yes. And I have a great admiration for her, even though we have a disagreement about part of the archaeology.
Right, the mascot.
But a dispute among friends.
Right. That's what happens in academia type things too.
Yeah, maybe. Archaeologists fight like mad.
Yeah. So why don't we talk a little bit about that dispute? It's the mascot saloon and what the findings tell us about the timing and the building?
Yeah, from the beginning, Paul and I thought it was a primary deposit, whereas Kathy got the notion when she was writing the report that it was waterworked. That is, the various floods in Skagway that are documented had moved that material underneath the Mascot Saloon. Paul Gleason and I, from the very beginning, we're a like-minded about it, mm-hmm. by the way. He was the excavator, she was the write-up person. So she was not present, but she had good material. But it's not to dispute about material, it's an interpretation.
Right.
So for years, Paul and I talked about this, and we were kind of frustrated because why'd she come up with that idea? We didn't quite agree with it. That water could deposit things, there seemed to be a pattern to it. And why were the peanut shells in certain locations only underneath the Mascot? Why didn't they float away? And I was always thinking about the nuts, mm-hmm. the shells. And then there were some bottles she found that were intact. And the whole thing looked like, and the drinking patterns had shifted. They went from whiskey to beer and wine, but still drinking whiskeys and stuff. But there was the Mascot had an earlier different pattern of drinking, which was largely whiskey, and that's a sign of early Skagway.
Okay, so the early inhabitants of Skagway somehow in other documentation were known to drink more whiskey.
Yes, because it was easier to ship.
Okay, beer and wine came later in their drinking habits, okay.
Because it took a while for the for them to develop sources,
mm-hmm.
and whiskey is easy to ship and put, it takes up less space and you can get drunker on it than lots of beer.
Right.
So later on, the Mascot became famous for its Rainier beer and all of that, but that's in the later days, you know, when stevedores and guys like that were.
Right. And so in that initial layer, you were finding more whiskey bottles.
Correct. And you have a drinking, there was some beer, but there was primarily whiskey drinking. In fact, they even drank Manhattans, because you find the cherry pits.
Oh, that seems like quite a sophisticated drink.
It is. But it was the only drink back then that was sort of a mixed drink.
Instead so it's of a an old shot. Yeah.
It's an old. It's one of the oldest cocktails.
I didn't know that.
So anyhow, the pattern seemed to me to be, as I've outlined in there, one of primary deposit rather than a secondary deposit caused by flooding, mm-hmm. and different washings over it, because the arrangement of the artifacts just didn't make sense otherwise, and it underneath that Mascot was very different from what you found outside. So Paul and I thought, we don't have a definitive answer, but there was an earlier Mascot that was either a tent or a building. There was a small building sitting there right near where the Mascot is early on in the footprint. They could have been selling liquor. So what we hypothesized was that it's more a primary deposit from the earliest days of Skagway. That is like 97, 98.
Right.
Didn't last long. Lasted a few months.
Right.
And then the real Mascot was built on top of it, thus sealing it in. We didn't think the nature of the floods were, there's swirling water. It was more like raising water. So it doesn't tend to have a turbulence to it.
I was wondering about the flooding, that the Mascot is what, 3rd and Broadway?
Yeah.
That, is it in a location that would have flooded?
It did flood.
So the Pullen Creek flooded?
Yeah. There was large floods in Skagway. And they would, you can see in the picture in Kathy's book, where the floodwaters are above the, just at the, kind of the foot of the Mascot.
I mean, I know that like the high tide could come up as far as the
teeth. Yeah, and I think it was a combination. I can't remember exactly how that, but there was both fresh water and I think at times they would just come up. But
I'm just surprised it would flood, because I know that it would flood to the depot and I could see the Skagway River flooding, but that's pretty far on the other side of town. But I suppose Pullen Creek could have come up, and then maybe the tide went all the way up to Third.
It could be the
combination.
Yeah, but the pictures don't show what turbulence is, but raised waters.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so anyway, I then summarized it in the report, and I forget sometimes what detail, but I went through the whole thing, Kathy's report, and the great thing about Kathy's report is from there I didn't have to do any more work. She had laid out enough detail, which is really amazing, that I could work with that material without supplement. That is, the data that mm-hmm. she presented was all there and beautifully presented. So I just reinterpreted it.
You didn't have to go back and look at the actual
correct
artifacts.
No.
Yeah.
And one reason I did that is I promised the curator in 2011 or 12, and I remember her name.
Was it Samantha Rickard?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I said, if it's primary, and I told Thibault the same, because we were talking, and I said, I'm going to revisit that when I get a chance after I retire. Are you interested? And they said, yes, because I said it transforms the artifacts, if I'm correct, from secondary to primary.
Mm-hmm.
It makes their value much more in significance because it's not a secondary deposit
right.
from floodwaters or just mixed things thrown under the mask.
Yeah, it shows more how that property was used through time.
Correct.
Versus things floating in and out.
Correct. And it's one of the earliest deposits from Skagway.
Yeah. I mean, I read just happened to have read it this morning to refresh my memory on what you had written. And you talk about the nails being the square nails.
Yes.
Which would have represented the earlier time
correct.
Period. And the wood chips that didn't look like what would have necessarily come into a flood.
Correct.
So all these details that it's very interesting how you put it all together.
Yeah, I tried. I did a lot of historical archaeology in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
So that started with it's similar kind of thing, like sleuthing. I think like a detective sometimes, and things bother me. Like I did compliance archaeology initially in the park and didn't expect to find anything because the geography was off and I didn't know any better. And then I got into historic material right away, and it was quite early. And then people said to me, oh, there's trash all over New Orleans. I said, it doesn't rain from the sky. There's a reason that it's here. It's,
right.
And this was concentrated. And that led to the finding of a house from the period of the battle.
Well, that's why I think that historic archaeology is very interesting. And I've learned from the Skagway Project by reading some of the reports that it's not just digging things out of the ground. You have to put it in context, and that means doing historical research.
Correct. And I used, for example, there, just like I used historical sources as best we could for thinking about Mascot and putting it in context, because why is this material different?
Mm-hmm.
And why is it in this particular spatial arrangement?
So what has happened in the final say? Kathy had her report and one interpretation, and you have a different interpretation.
Correct.
So now what?
People can make up their mind. I didn't publish that. I gave it to the park, and I shared it with the region. And that was what my purpose was,
mm-hmm.
to have it there, and Carl could decide. It's at least it exists, and
right.
I promised I'd do it, and I did it. And so
well, I don't know if there's any way to come to a definitive
no,
answer.
Yeah, Gleason and I think we're right. And Kathy thinks maybe otherwise. I think I told her, I think I sent her a copy.
Probably.
I'm friendly with her. I haven't seen her for a while, but I admire her. So this is not where I'm...
Right.
I'm doing the old archaeology. Well, here's what I see going on. And I had that feeling from the minute that we crawled under there, and Gleason and I went, why is the report doing this?
Well, does it happen in archaeology in general that somebody comes along later and reinterprets?
Oh, yeah. Well, see, that's what I did.
Right. That's a normal practice in archaeology?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You can look at... One person sees one thing and another person sees another. So the archaeologist prior to me didn't question anything. There was only two. Rex Wilson, who'd done some work there, he was very interested in what I was doing because he had done the initial work there and he hadn't discovered what I did. But I was working on they were going to put a new interpretive center in. But there you get the puzzle. You get, why is this material here? Instead, people say, oh, it's just there. It just happens. No. You have, and then I predicted that battery 3 would be at this one location. It took me a while to find it. It took me 2 weeks.
That was the New Orleans battlefield?
Yeah, so I did a historical house there, and then I found another one from the 18th century, which was the boyhood home of the pirate Renato Belluche. In the 18th century.
Wow.
And I had a dispute there with an archivist, a historical archivist, who said, no, anyway, that report, I followed up. Things fit, like we found on aerial photographs a historical British fort. It's now destroyed, but it was an earth fort on the Battle of New Orleans, and it was just on the... I used Dale Davenport, who's at the park, at the regional office, who's an expert in GPS and remote sensing. And we worked using the photograph and we discovered that. So I've been able to lock in geographical areas. So that's just how my brain... I get puzzled with things.
Yeah.
And if they don't fit in my brain, I gotta puzzle them out because why is this here? And if that's the case, then something else is there. But that's where I got my background in kind of puzzles.
Mm-hmm.
And Skagway remained a puzzle in my mind till my retirement. And I got to get this out. And they said, Teresa and what's her name? Samantha said, sure, do it. But I didn't see it as I haven't turned it into an article. I wanted it, it was commissioned, so to speak, by the park. I didn't get paid.
Right.
I'm working on Guam now.
Oh.
I had some leftovers from there.
Well, I was wondering on the...
And I have one more Skagway story.
Okay, go ahead.
And that has got to do with history. And maybe 2004, they were planning... You may know the date, but the state was planning the road that was going to go into Skagway. Came from Juneau. They were planning a major road.
Right. I don't know when that planning started.
Somewhere around then. Marcia Blazak was the regional director. And that was in her era. So I think if I remember right, 2004.
They're still talking about it. There isn't a road yet, but they keep talking about it.
But there was a big fight over Skagway, and it was probably my last big thing relative to... And Frank Norris had rewritten at the behest of Sandy, had rewritten early on historical context for the National Landmark, because it's a Skagway disc, that whole area, bigger than the park properties, is historic landmark.
Mm-hmm.
And so that came under our public cultural resources assistance program. which the Park Service has, this where we advise, we look after the landmarks, report on their status, write up backgrounds and context for them. And Frank had redone the one for Skagway and included the landscape that we wanted to preserve its context in terms of the landscape of mm-hmm. Skagway. And this road was going to come in and an elevated road coming into Skagway from the side of the mountain. And it was quite prominent and would really interfere with the whole historic scene that had been outlined by Frank and had been approved. This was it was part of the record, mm-hmm. part of the significance of the landmark. And so the state got really upset when we said, hey, and they said, well, we've been through this and we had a contractor and they say it's not, it's fine. There is no landscape aspect to this park and the landmark designation. Mm-hmm. So, and Sandy can fill you in more on that. I think she was there. It's before she left. I could be a little bit off if she remembers, but it may have been after she left. She left in 2004 for Southwest Region, where she was the cultural resource person. Mm-hmm. But Frank Norris and I were at least talking, and the state got really upset and called the regional director because we said, your compliance is off. You're affecting the thing that makes this landmark significant, and you're going to impair the historic scene, which is outlined in the landmark provision done by Frank Norris. So it's a brief story, but I got a call on the carpet, and I think Frank was with me, and the state asked for the regional director and Vic Knox, who was deputy director, to go and talk to their commissioner, and they had a big meeting with me. The regional, Vic Knox got very worried. He says, he wanted me to do the Clay Alderson thing, just say yes. I said, I can't say yes. Because my program also covers that, right. The external program. And later on, I dealt with Nike Site Summit, and I was the lead on that to actually, in that case, the SHPO was looking for my help. But mm-hmm. was initially, I seemed to have a way of getting people riled up. Because then the colonel got really mad at me because I said, you're destroying the Nike Site Summit, this Cold War right. thing. And then I had to demonstrate that with help of staff. But I wrote the main thing. So I get into history and architect, it's weird. And I appreciate it all.
You're a Renaissance man.
I'm not in real life, but I really like, I'm a kind of a cultural resource tourist.
Yeah.
So.
So this landmark thing, the road, you got.
Well, the key to that thing, I got them in where the commissioner, and I forget for what the official title is.
So is it the DOT commissioner for the road, Department of Transportation?
That's correct. You're okay. correct. And the Vic Knox, the deputy director, got very upset and wanted to find a way to say yes. I had to then go into with the regional director, Marcia Blazak, and I forget what other associates there were, mm-hmm. get grilled. And I said, we can't change our minds on this. I can't tell you it's okay, because right. it's not okay. It's going to have a significant negative impact on the landmark as it's defined and alter that historical feel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's built in. And the state says, well, we don't know anything about that. And we had to point out you had used the wrong landmark. Their contractor, who they had hired, had used the earlier landmark designation and documentation, and was not aware, even though it wasn't hidden.
Right.
They just, so the state was under the impression everything was okay. That was probably my last big thing. You know, I stood my ground again, and it didn't get built yet.
Right.
Now, they have to figure out how to mitigate that effect, either in the design or something, or there's going to be another fight. But at least it stalled it for a while.
Right. Or different players in different administrations.
Yeah, like today. I have no idea.
Yeah, somebody else might say, okay, yes, whatever.
Correct.
You don't know.
But I was supported by, I remember it was Frank, and you have to ask Sandy if she was there. I can't remember her now. I remember Frank. So it may have been just after she left. So it was about toward the end of my, it was mid-decade.
Right.
Yeah. But I'm not so good on memory. I don't have a photographic memory.
No, well, I'm terrible at remembering dates. And here I ask people all the time, and I can't remember dates. But we were talking about some of the things you were proud of that you accomplished, like the CRAC and the publishing program and getting archaeologists and historians out into the park.
Right.
Were there things that you wished you'd been able to accomplish and didn't? In frustrations you had with the job?
I had a great staff, with one exception, which was my cross.
Right.
But I feel really good about, like Becky's, in terms of Skagway, Becky's report is like the dessert.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I'm very happy where I think the parks and that turned out really good. I thought that needed to be done for the public.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very oriented in the program to get things out to the public.
Mm-hmm.
We just before I left, they published a bunch of brochures on Seward so that you can be used in the walking tour and you can have a sense of place there. And the park supported that because they're so integrated with the town.
Right.
And so those are like, that was my last archaeological work, which was also historical.
Right.
Because we were working on the lots there at where this parking lot was, the Shea lots. And I got to do when I volunteered, actually, my wife was, we were down there fishing with my son-in-laws. And the crew who was included, Becky, they just didn't have the oomph to get what was necessary to get done. And so I threw myself into it. I was the dumpster archaeologist because they got a picture of me sitting by a dumpster writing up stuff. But we were doing latrines.
There were
time capsules. They were super good.
Well, that's what Kathy Spoody did in Skagway.
She did.
The latrine archaeology, which I'd never even heard of before.
it's like little time capsules if they've been kept, because generally you only use them for a while and then you top them over.
Right.
And you threw trash and crap in there. And so they're wonderful. But
sounds very unpleasant, but I suppose it is after,
it's like compost.
Yeah.
It's just no doo-doo.
Yeah.
It's
they don't smell or?
No.
Oh, okay.
They smell like compost.
Yeah.
Except they're full of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, bones and
right. Well, plates. In Kathy's, it was bottles in the priest's,
yes,
whatever it was, latrine.
She did a great job on that.
Yeah.
And
I was amazed. Like, you can tell all that from looking at bottles?
She's very good at, the only exception I've ever had with her is the mascot, underneath the mascot.
Right.
Other than that, she's...
And the mascot was the only Klondike project you kind of got
involved in. Correct. Getting, I was involved in getting the whole big picture of the archaeology and the reports done.
Right.
And that's where I meant that Becky's report is the dessert.
Right.
It's like, ah, and I had the mascot done.
Right.
And despite my dispute with her about interpretation, that was a wonderful day.
Right.
And those are things that made my day.
Mm-hmm. Were there obstacles you faced in the Park Service?
All the time.
And such as?
Well,
and how did you get around them?
I told you about the landmark thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was my ability, I think, to argue. I'm somewhat diplomatic, as best I can be,
mm-hmm.
but I hold my ground. So when it's right, when I feel that I have a position that needs defense, I will argue. My wife will tell you I like to argue. But it's more from a passion for the doing the right thing. So where I didn't get resistance for starting CRAC. I had to fight Russ Gallipo so it's a combination of me being both diplomatic but standing my ground.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was the reluctant bridesmaid, but then Paul Hartel was stronger than Russ was the resource manager for Ringel St. Elias then, I think. But he had a high status. He was recognized as the premier resource manager for the region among mm-hmm. the parks. So I told him I had to stand my ground because I have to have representation for cultural resources. I can't do less. I just can't be the only token member.
Right.
So there I was supported eventually by Paul Hartel. I won that round. Most of the time, it's the hardest. Let me just finish this thought, but I would say I had a good staff. And also, I was listened to after a while. People would listen to me because I was generally not jacking them around. I tried to be not a cultural resource Nazi, of which there are some that are terrible people, because they ruin our cultural resource world.
Well, I was also wondering that National Park Service historically has not been known as a cultural resource-oriented
Correct.
Organization. They're much natural resources and recreation. And
yes.
Things. So what was it like being in cultural resources in a bureaucracy that was not used to that?
You're a second-grade citizen.
And how do you deal with that?
Oh, my solution was to get the parks to have their own people and for them to have their own money and their responsibility through the CRAC Advisory Council, and then the superintendents getting to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And they could veto a project if they wanted. Normally they weren't comfortable. But that got us to where at least, it's like Clay Alderson became an advocate for the archaeology of the park, mm-hmm. which he had started not being. So it's like Sandy can tell you more because she dealt with it at the national level. And what I was going to say is the hardest thing is selling 106.
That's the compliance.
Yeah. Because they see that as like, ooh, why do I have to comply with this? You know, what? I want this maintenance shed. I want this other thing. Why can't we have a road? You know, like today.
Right.
Why do I have to send archaeologists out? Katmai has been terrible about that. They're maintenance people. Gene Schaaf has dealt with a lot of problems there. So the most difficult thing is to convince them that 106 is good.
So how did you sell it? You obviously succeeded in some ways at selling it. What was your spiel?
Oh, I don't know what I said. I've got to think about how I... Marsha Blazak started, was good in listening to me. Bob Barbie even would listen. But we were always, we always needed to convince them. You know, and by highlighting the resource and its importance to history or archaeology, you have to explain why why is this important? Because your park, like Skagway, is about history and archaeology. That's what, and curation too. I had some good curators, Gene Rodick, and then Stephanie Stevens, who was very good selling curation. She did a marvelous job with our budget guy, who I was in disputes with often. He was always he was mad at me because I hired somebody once and he didn't like it. And it was an impaired employee. Mm. They were, we didn't have much of a record of hiring people who were disabled.
Right.
And I had a chance and I had a fit. And he worked for Becky Salibi, but the guy told me, he says, I'm gonna take my pound of flesh from you. But Stephanie was able to win him over. So mm-hmm. part of it was my staff. It's people like Sandy, who sold cultural resources. We tried not to be Nazis, but we tried to stand our ground and try to convince them, this is stuff that's really important to your park. Sandy and Steve sold Getting Kennicott in as part of the Wrangell St. Elias. They couldn't care less about it at the beginning.
Wow, now it's like the huge attraction for the park.
We knew it was. That's what we're trying to tell them. You can't, this is not something you want to cut out. You want to take it in. Yeah. It's the heart of the park.
Now. Right. Well, were there times with 106 compliance or things where you tried to convince and you failed?
Well, the little story about Clay the first time, yeah. Right. But that took my boss.
Right.
And if I had a boss that supported me, or a regional director like Marsha Blazak, she's the one who overrode the deputy director on that landmark issue.
But it seems like in the Park Service, then, the way you're explaining it, a lot of it depends on the people in the various positions.
Yes, and their credibility with that group. So
that to accomplish things, you have to have people higher up support you, and if they don't, you're stuck.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting that it's so, because it is such a big bureaucracy. It's interesting to think that the individual personalities play such a part.
I think they do. Sandy was a good seller of cultural resources. Stephanie Stevens was a great salesman for curation, and she has a very nice, well, now she's gone on to be the chief curator of the National Park Service, but she was able to be, she's the only person I know who could make fun of the directorate in their face, and they would all laugh. She has a great personality. And she had an ability to be lighthearted about it, and yet she would like critique them. You could hear her voice sometimes. Oh, and I would have been killed, but they accepted her. Sandy was a good spokesperson and seller, and Steve Peterson was a real good salesman for historical architecture. And when he gained the confidence of the maintenance guys, which he did in all the parks, I think they really liked him because he's a hands-on guy.
Yeah.
And so is Grant.
Yeah.
And they liked that. And so they're part of my sales pitch. Tim Cochran, who I told you about, was a great salesman for ethnography. Then I got Don Calloway, who was less of a salesman, but a real expert in subsistence and statistics. And he was also had a firm backbone, but he could also explain things, you know, how this worked. And Tim initially was so cultural, and at that time Errol Crespi was hated in the Park Service by most regular people I had to deal with, because she was abrasive and irritating to them. And where Tim was soft sell, and he did a good job as superintendent, that he converted Glacier Bay from being anti-Indian. Yeah. They were really weird.
And now they have a big, beautiful new cultural facility there. Yeah.
And and Michelle Jesperson is still there.
Yeah.
And Wayne Howell was there.
I think he's retired.
Yeah, he's like old like me, like Jim Bradford, who was regional archaeologist in the Southwest after me. Or I was never regional, but he became the, but he
after
worked
the,
for me.
Yeah.
So I got to credit a good staff, especially my, we didn't call them branch anymore. I forgot what we called them because they didn't, the earlier bureaucratic language didn't work out. Units or something.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I was, it actually was one of my questions was just the whole concept of, as an archaeologist, moving into that Park Service structure and bureaucracy and power structure of all those different levels, how you fit into all that.
I was always a second grade citizen, so was Sandy. What was good was when we had bosses who were in the center of the Park Service, like Ralph Tingey and Paul Hartel, then they would listen to us. So part of it was my relationship with my good bosses, because they would then speak out on our behalf.
Did you feel, did you enjoy working in that infrastructure of the Park Service?
Did I adapted to it. But it was really good when I had Ralph Tingey for years as a boss, who was a ranger in background, but highly respected. So when he spoke, he was not as powerful as Hartel was, because they changed their standards a little bit and gave more power to the superintendent, so he couldn't veto them. He could advise against it. The regional director could do that, but regional directors rarely interfere very much, because the Park Service is like a medieval kingdom.
Right. Well, that's what I was wondering, like working in that environment, how you get along.
It's difficult at times.
Yeah.
It's the most difficult thing, I think, is administration. I don't know if the Soviet Union has produced these people when it collapsed, but the administrators make life horrible. Contracts take forever. Everything slows down. I remember that was one of the hardest things we had, the Indian Assistance Program. No, excuse me. The Rural Development Program out of UAF. It's now Indian, it's
Indigenous
called
studies.
No, Native Alaska and Rural Development Program. It's a headquartered now at UAF. It used to have Gordon Puller.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Well, for me to get a contract on that generally took me 9 months. And cooperative
agreements. Yeah.
It take and I'd repeat it every year, and they would look at it and look at it. It's only a few pages long, and I would have to go up there and sit hand in hand, basically, with the administrators and go, oh, I've done this, I've done that, what haven't I done, why is it not moving forward? So it was just this constant keeping a relationship with them, because the paperwork is so weird. And it's the Park Service contracting is the most difficult thing. It's like, it's often very little money, but they are so, there's so many obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
And they just seem to get bigger. I as I told you, I in the Indian Assistance Program, my early career in the Park Service, I was used to handling $400,000, being the advisor, contracting officer's representative.
Mm-hmm.
And contracting the BIA with the Navajo was easy. It was, well, with the Hopi too, it was easy. We'd get it done. And the things would happen. And they handled big money because they did some huge projects that beyond archaeology. Because we were, and then there was, so I was used till I got into the Park Service, and then I was dealing with pennies. I was always like pushing, it's like pushing pennies with your nose. And that was true in Southwest region as well as Alaska.
That was my question. Is it just, was it unique to Alaska? No, no, it's just the Park Service in general.
Petty. They don't have a good system that way. At least that's my comparison to what I knew in the BIA, which is not known as his most efficient agency in the world.
Yeah.
But they handle things pretty good. And the Corps of Engineers was pretty good. Because I had a relationship with them for in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And they paid my money. I got basically the work I did for the rearranging the geography of the park was paid for by Corps of Engineers.
Well, we were talking about, you know, how important relationships and people and personalities, and you mentioned Teresa Thibault.
Yes.
And I don't know if you're probably aware that she was not always the most
diplomatic person
or popular, easiest to get along with.
Correct.
From the park perspective.
Yes.
I don't know if you have any commentary on that particular scenario and what happened there.
I didn't get involved in I was supportive of her, but she could be a difficult person, a personality, and at times she could be prickly. And so I couldn't, you can't tell anyone to be anything. You just deal with what you can and try to convince them to do the best by a situation. But we had our times where she didn't agree with me, particularly in CRAC. She could be, she was often the bookkeeper for us, and she would be and fussy. I respected her, but I knew that she wasn't the easiest person to get along with at the park level. But it was hard for us to get it. It was not for me to tell a park what to do.
Okay. Do you think...
I could advise them what to do, and I dealt with a few things like that, but...
she may not have been the only...
she was not.
Difficult situation.
There was others with other parks, and sometimes they would ask her opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they wouldn't and wouldn't listen, and we would give hints that there were worse people than Teresa.
Well, and I was also wondering if having a person in that she was head of resources.
Yes,
in that position, who might be difficult person to relate to, if that affected your ability or the park's ability to accomplish projects. Did you ever experience that? Was it an obstacle to getting your work done? Your meaning, I guess, your department's.
You mean the regional office?
Yeah, or were you aware of that there were projects the park wanted that didn't get done because somebody wouldn't...
In her case, no. I'm aware of, I just knew that she was difficult at times and the people were not always happy, but they had hired her. I didn't.
Right.
And that happened to me. You'd say, don't do that. And if you hire that person, and then they would come to me with the moans. I had that, but it wasn't Skagway. It was another park, and they said they had buyer regrets. And I said, you never asked us. You just went ahead and hired.
Well, that leads to the question of the relationship between the individual parks and regional from the cultural resource sites, what that relationship was and how you worked together or did not work together.
Once, at the beginning of my tenure as a cultural resource person and regional archaeologist, because there I had some, I gained archaeological money, then I was in charge of allocating money with my staff to the parks.
Mm-hmm.
We brought in one resource manager to help advise us when we sat down and parlayed the money out. So at that point, there aren't people, there's maybe one or two people in the parks to give it to, but basically we're allocating to money, and we would do some of those projects. I mean, staff.
Right, because
we would hire temporaries or whatever it took, or terms, and do the work. Later on, then it was the parks doing the deciding, and unless they were doing some special project, like administrative histories with Frank Norris.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to do those or hire people for it. That's something that we would do for them.
Right.
So what our job was to supplement their, what they didn't have strengths in, is to provide that. So what it did is shifted from us making decisions about research money and what should be done in a park and advising a superintendent what you should do, is their staff was starting to do that. But the instrument by which monies were allocated was through the, and they got their own compliance money, was the, but for their research and their rehabilitation and stuff came through CRAC, and then in the case of historical architecture, was between Steve Peterson and the maintenance
mm-hmm.
group. So we became more helpers than we could not tell parks what to do.
And did that, what was the park response to those changes?
They were, some people could be difficult at times. And other times we'd get along and everything was fine. But we didn't have a veto. So it was like the UN. So there's people who, so you have, it's like getting down, or maybe NATO.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe NATO's better because we had common interests, you know, in the culture mm-hmm. research, but we didn't always agree on how best to accomplish things. So I'd be an advocate sometimes for a particular park, if, like I said about Sitka for their survey, because people didn't understand how difficult the job was and it hadn't been sold well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, from my outside perspective, I would think if I were in a park, I would prefer to have the park making its own decisions versus being told from regional
correct.
What to do.
And that's what we
intuitively were, that makes sense to me, but maybe it didn't to other people who were used to a different system.
In the Park Service, a lot of regions like Western Region, Cultural Resources, which Sandy broke down, that's cultural center was dictatorial at times
mm-hmm.
and it really irritated parks. Some of the parks when I was in Southwest Region were also grumpy, and because they didn't have people in them.
Yeah.
And so it's like regions telling us what to do, and they don't like that anyway.
Right. That's
but for cultural resource people who are secondary citizens, that's even worse.
Yeah, okay. Were there times when Washington would tell a park or a region what to do?
They would set parameters for us, and then we'd have to sell that we needed money. Like Sandy and I were going for money for the parks, and they said at one point Jerry Rogers, head of the cultural resources for the Park Service, said, "Oh, Alaska doesn't need money. You do so well with so little." And we were going, we need money. We eventually got his deputy to allocate us a proper a distribution in Alaska. So we had to then also, we had meetings where all the regional people would get together with the head of cultural, and they would allocate money that way. Eventually it became, we got a certain set sum, but it took Alaska, and Sandy is instrumental with me in getting a good allocation of money to Alaska, both in the public sector and our in-park work. Mm-hmm. So that was where we get a set amount, and that would vary. The distribution was like a percentage,
okay,
going to the different regions. But we, under my time, I was able to get, with Sandy's help, who was a good spokesperson, a better allocation to Alaska, which was then viewed as having not very much in cultural resources. That is, you don't need money, you don't have anything.
Right.
And then we had to make the case we have more archaeological sites in our parks than the entire Park Service. We estimate, estimate is that there's probably, I think we figured out there's at least 400,000 sites, archaeological sites in the parks in Alaska. It's the longest, it's got such huge land area. People couldn't fathom how. So even if you have people dispersed like the Nunavut in Gates of the Arctic, over the years, in this huge, vast thing, there are tons of sites. It isn't like some little park in the Southwest.
Right.
You know.
And they were nomadic, so there was lots of sites all over.
Yeah, the Nunavuts did their job. I got to do a little of that, and. I discovered an 8,000-year-old site there, Paleoarctic thing.
Wow.
And I was on one of my recons, and it got done by the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
And what site was that?
Tingmiyukpak.
Which is?
In the Gates of the Arctic.
In the Gates of the Arctic, cool.
And it was kind of getting, I think Roberts did work, and then Owen Mason did follow-up geomorphology of the site.
Mm-hmm.
But Alaska has sites going back to 14,000.
Well, and like Cape Espenberg
and
Cape Kruzenstern.
Unbelievable.
Huge.
I was out there with Gleason. We walked Cape Kruzenstern just to kind of scout it out, because that we wanted to get work done there, and then there was follow-up work, and has been continuing to this day.
Right.
So one of my jobs was to sell Washington on all these things. So I used to write for they had a little Park Service cultural resource thing, newsletter, and I would write little articles on how much archaeology there was. Yes, there are cultural resources in Alaska.
Yeah. So in the position as head of cultural resources, you're a manager and a supervisor and an advocate.
Yes.
And a funder.
Yes. So you have to make the case that you need Washington's help.
Yeah. It's a lot of different hats you have to wear. And you interact with Washington, interact with the parks, interact with regional staff.
Correct.
A lot to juggle.
Yeah, it was a tough job, but I liked it. But it was, well, the president once said, Jennifer Pedersen Weinberg, I think is her name. She told me, she said, this is a really hard job. Because you're not in power. You're basically a line supervisor. You're not part of the director.
Uh-huh.
So you're, and then you have to help your staff manage all that. Then you deal with Washington
right. This
way, because it isn't the regional director who deals with it. That's you who has to advocate for the region. Now you try to get their support.
You also have to advocate to the regional director as well, don't you?
Oh, yes.
And then you're There's also a head of natural resources.
Yeah, and then there's, right. Yes, and you work with them when the occasion.
But are you fighting for the same pots of money?
The money, cultural money and the natural money are separate. Except for the staff money.
Mm-hmm.
But the fund money, the research kind of money and the basic, but you are looking for positions and operational funds.
But some parks in Alaska just have one resources department and there's one head of resources, there's not cultural and natural?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And that's more common than not. And then for the resource person, generally the archaeologist works under them. Thiebaud was both.
Right.
So she became a resource manager. Generally, the cultural person is under a natural resource person,
okay,
who is called a resource manager.
Okay, but she was the resource manager with a cultural background.
Yes, and I think she was a rare one.
Yeah.
Do
some parks have both a head of cultural and a head of natural?
I'm not aware of that.
It's just one resource manager.
Yeah, okay. Normally.
Okay.
I may have forgotten somebody. Jeff Rasick has a lot of status in Gates of the Arctic.
Yeah, but he comes from an archaeology. Yeah, I don't know if he's head of resources.
I don't think, unless
he... I think he is. I can't remember.
He may have been made that because he got along with the superintendent really well and he's a really good manager.
Yeah, he may have moved into that. I can't remember.
I haven't kept up with his status.
But you were saying how...
Most of the time... It's resource managers and then cultural people working for them.
Right.
So you had to convince them too. And they could come, often they were at CRAC. Sometimes they brought their staff.
Mm-hmm.
But the park could appoint the representative. So they could, if they felt like it, be there. And that was true of Jeff's boss, because mm-hmm. he worked for Tom, he called himself Ted of the North. It was a joke.
Yeah. You were Ted of the South?
I guess. But he was a natural guy and Jeff worked for him and he'd like to come to the meetings. So Jeff would be there as an advisor.
Right.
He wasn't a member.
And CRAC met how often?
Every year.
Just once a year?
Once a year to allocate funds and make other decisions, generally for about 2 to 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would meet on the phone. We would also, yeah. So there was interaction as a CRAC member.
Mm-hmm.
So you weren't the park person, you were the park person, but you were interacting with them as a member of CRAC.
Right.
And that worked pretty good, I think, on the whole. There were some disputes, but on the whole, we got pretty good at allocations, and they became more, this is what you deserve, and go do something with it, correct.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then they would allocate it back to my staff, like if they needed a historian like mm-hmm. Frank, or an ethnologist to help, you know, work on subsistence.
The part of the project.
Yeah, so I would say, but Park Service subordinates cultural resources generally to the resource manager.
Yeah. Well, you were saying that, you know, it's obviously being head of cultural resources was a hard job, but you liked it.
Yeah.
Were there things that you didn't like about it? Or what was something that was the hardest about it?
I would say dealing with administration. It's just the administrative bureaucracy of the Park Service for some reason just seems to me to be just...
But some people, you obviously manage to put up with it. Other people aren't able to put up with it and probably don't have a career in the Park Service.
Well, they get pushed out. I mean, what
the
happens
people
is...
People get frustrated and just say, I can't do this and leave.
Well, I knew I couldn't do that. I just had to roll with the punches is probably a good way to describe mm-hmm. it. So sometimes I won, sometimes I lost, and I just had to keep plugging. And Sandy will give you a similar story about it. You get beat up.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have a lot of power, so you've got to convince people all the time. You're always trying to be persuasive without being outrageous. It's taxing, and my successor has found that. She started working on weekends soon after she got there. And I used to work late. And
what did you do in life to counter that stress or those frustrations? Like, you didn't work weekends, it said, or you did?
I did, normally, no.
So what would you do with your free time?
Oh, well, I belonged to about 3 hiking groups before my feet got bad. I cross-country skied. I had 2 daughters. We had a cabin out at Big Lake, it's really Flat Lake. And, now I remember the guy's name, Tom Leibscher. I don't know if you ever knew.
Yes, I remember the name.
But we had a good relationship on the whole. I always tried to be, I try not to be, like I say, a Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, I guess, take blows, you know, and then you just keep going.
Yeah.
Because you have no alternative. You don't have power. So you've got to convince your bosses to be your power. You've got to convince Parks to do the right thing. So you're always selling them.
Yeah, it sounds tiring after a while.
It did. It was... I liked the work, but it was not easy, like Jennifer's found out, because you're always fighting for the budget, to have enough people, to have the ability to do the work, to have publication money, and you're dealing with the external public, like on historic landmarks. We had a fair amount of authority on that, and you dealing with the state and other entities. And then once in a while, like when I piss off the army, you got beat upstairs.
Oh, yeah.
But the weird thing is the army had to ask me to be their advisor, because I was the only one who could mediate between them and the ship.
This was for Site Summit.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would get beat up. But I liked the work. I felt I was accomplishing things. You asked me if I had any regrets. The only regret I have is I couldn't do more.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have anything like, I would say overall it was satisfying.
Yeah, I was thinking it must have been worthwhile to continue to put up with the being beat up and...
Yeah,
because
you can get beat up by Parks, you can get beat up by Washington, and...
So something about it was worthwhile to you to stick with.
Well, that was the cultural resources to... I'm a, basically a historic preservationist.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I mean, I liked the ethnology parts that we were doing. We felt these were things that were important to people, living people. And then the past is important, and we felt the public needed it. That's part of our orientation and our publications.
Mm-hmm.
At least get the information out there so somebody else could do something with it. Like this Seward people did.
Right.
I think it was an interpreter who wrote down the little brochures mm-hmm. from the archaeological work we'd done there. And then Becky writing hers, which is very accessible, and that was the intent, to get it to the public. This is your history, you know?
Right.
And it's through archaeology. Now, there's history, too, but archaeology can inform history.
Right.
So all of that stuff was... I think the satisfying thing is... Yeah, I think I may have said that in there in the interview, that it was being able to accomplish important stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I planned to become a professor. And I wasn't on Guam, that was my trajectory.
Right.
I actually wanted to eventually get a job at University of Oregon. That was my big goal then.
Oh, yeah.
Because they had a Pacific orientation. A guy named Ayres was doing great work. And I thought, well, I was the only one in Guam, but I was thinking then, well, I have something unique. Nobody else has much worked on Guam except me and Fred Ryman and a few others. And I thought, well, that's where I'm going to go. Till I came back, finished the dissertation, and then got the call from my friend.
Right.
And I went, that sounds intriguing. And
that's sometimes how life works.
So then I learned about Section 106, and I actually had an epiphany in 1976 when I finally understood how it all worked, and it was one of the most beautiful laws in the world. I can see the light, how this works, because you've got to account for cultural resources.
Right.
It's this planning operation. And it's got a federalist nature to it because the states are involved.
Mm-hmm.
And then the tribes came involved. So you're consulting. And for some reason that appeals to me, a consultative mm-hmm. relationship with the people you work with, be they external or in the Park Service. And so that was, I took a turn in life. And somebody once told me, you're really good at it. And I went, that kind of encouraged me to stay in that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was negotiating for a while to go back to Guam to get an associate professorship there. And then I realized, no, this is probably my way.
Yeah.
People think I'm good at it. I feel satisfied by it, even though it can be frustrating. See, I was used to Guam. This is very frustrating. It's got rotten politics.
Yeah.
The SHPO just now was fired for corruption. I'm not kidding you. I just sent her a bunch of stuff because I had some artifacts from that period that I was supposed to look at, and I sent everything back to her. And I was corresponding with her because I'm working on a second report. I did an earlier report. These are all volunteer things I just do to discharge.
Right.
And she got fired. A friend of mine is the naval archaeologist there. Well, one of my students
mm-hmm.
from back
then.
That's
fun.
And she said, don't send any more to her. There's chaos. I got trained in frustration in Guam because I had to deal with salvage archaeology for no money, just a little pittance to write up stuff and have work-study students. And then I had a marine biologist doing the artifact, the shells and fish bones. And I had to pay her something to help her out, and I got the Insular Arts Council to give me money, but most of the time I had too many classes to teach. I was so frustrated because I couldn't work on the dissertation.
Right.
That was driving me crazy, and my committee was going nuts. So Guam, see, people would come to me and they'd say, would you call out the Republicans for having a party on the beach and ruining artifacts and sites. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that, because they were trying to politicize things.
Right.
And I stayed out of trouble in Guam, but I had to negotiate very carefully among the faculty. At one point I had a tug of war with one of the administrators over a table that I had for my work-study students. And then they stole it and took it. After I had gone home, they took it and put their coffee on it. And there was things.
So yeah, you were well practiced in that by the time you got to the Park Service.
Yeah, and then I had a second thing, which was the Indian Assistance Program, where I'm dealing with energy people, right. Mobile oil. And I turned a guy around, Dan Hurley, first had to deal with me on drilling. And sites in Israel, right in the middle of one of the more important site areas in the Southwest. I mean, it's thick. And he was pretty hostile. But he came around and won a historic preservation award by the state. Because I convinced him mm-hmm. the importance of the stuff, and I got him to start. I said, if you're worried about archaeologists being inaccurate, why don't you measure it? You're an engineer, you know, a mining engineer, you know how to do this. And he did beautiful work. He could drill amongst ruins and protected the ruins from people who were looters.
Wow.
And he did win an award for his work. And he was a gruff, mobile old guy, but we became friends. And so I dealt with some, like I told you the story about people trying to fire me, who, you know, with the Reagan administration, right. And all this stuff. So I got used to, and working with Indian people is not always easy. Like the Hopi, mm-hmm. there can be some difficulties, but we did archaeological work with the Hopi. I had an Indian boss for a while. Mm-hmm. And so that gave me a perspective. So Guam prepared me for that. Then that was, you're still advisory and you're a secondary person. The BIA didn't love archaeology, and especially Section 106, but they were pretty good on the whole in listening to us. We had the program had a credibility, mm-hmm. trust thing. Right. And we had a good trust relationship most of the time with the Indian peoples.
Well, then coming to Alaska, you'd learn this cross-cultural communication, which is very important in Alaska as well.
Yes, and that's why I got involved in the Indian Native Alaskan and Rural Development Program, the
right.
UAF.
Right.
And Sandy was the founder of that. And then when she left, I continued to work, but I used to participate. And that was one of my favorite things.
Yeah.
We put on a seminar every year and helped fund that. And one of my things was to get the cooperative agreement in place so we'd get paid. And help the students, because they got scholarships to come to the seminars, which we held all over Alaska.
Right. Yeah, I remember when that went on.
And now I think it's died. Rachel was dealing with it.
Yeah, there's still some going on, I think, but I'm not sure.
But the money shrunk.
Yeah.
But so I was used to frustration.
Mm-hmm.
And cultural resources for, Sandy will tell you, are frustrating because you're always a secondary citizen.
Right.
So you're sort of like a black in a white society.
Yeah.
Especially in the Park Service, which the highest ranking people are, the most respected are rescue rangers, law enforcement rangers. And that's where they get the superintendents
right.
from usually.
They come from that pool.
Well, if they want a hard park, and a hard park is like Denali.
Right.
It's mainly natural resources. That's why Randall St. Elias didn't want a Kennecott in there, because that's soft.
Right.
And so a hard park is Glacier Bay. A soft park is like Fort Union.
Mm-hmm. And Klondike is more considered a soft park.
Yes.
Even though there's the Chilkoot Trail.
That doesn't count as much as that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Sitka.
Yeah.
They're not...
They're soft parks.
Yeah. They actually use that term hard and soft.
Yeah, I think I've heard that. Well, Ted, you've talked for a long time today. You're probably exhausted.
I can talk. But I'm sorry, I can't always remember.
No. I just thought maybe we'd wrap up if there was anything else related to Klondike.
I had good fun there. I didn't do the archaeology there except through the write-up here. My job was to... to get the archaeology done.
Were there other things that you helped get done for Klondike besides archaeology, like history or projects?
Sandy did much more with that, and Frank, and my job was to make their job easier.
Okay.
I did a lot of administrative interference. I tried to give them the platforms they needed to do their job. So I didn't have a lot to do with it. I did with the landmark on that occasion.
Right.
And that's where I'd come in. When the going got tough, that was when I had to do what I could. And I can't say that there was, you know, relative to the Klondike, I was happy with the outcome. Like I said, it's got a dessert even with it.
Right.
And I did what I set out to do, which is to get, I'd say 90% of the reports were written up and published. Mm-hmm. And then the dessert one by Becky Salibi, which also gave the public access to
right.
it.
So you didn't have anything to do with any projects on the Chilkoot or out in Dyea?
Oh, well, only as a oversight supervisor, like the White Pass report.
Oh, the Julie Johnson's.
Yeah, that kind of thing. So I'd be involved in arguing for it, you know, whatever. My job was in
that. But that Julie, the White Pass one, was that something Sandy spearheaded and got going?
Yeah.
Okay.
She can tell you a lot about that. So I was more distant from that.
Okay.
So I let Sandy do her thing. It's when I had to step in when there was some messy stuff.
And what counts as messy stuff? Funding or?
Funding, administrative problems, everything.
Okay.
Like shepherding cooperative agreements through, or someone yelling about the landmark in Skagway. That's a typical thing where I had to deal
okay.
with. And I'm, like I said, I try to be diplomatic because I don't have power.
Right.
You have to convince people, and if you can't convince them, you lose.
Right.
And
then
most,
you don't get anything done.
And you can't just become stiff. You've got to be flexible, and you've got to roll with the punches because the punches are coming. I got to say, there was a lot. It's a lot nicer being, I don't regret retiring. I liked the work, but it was hard, and I figured out it was 14 years till I was 80, so at 66
it's time to go.
Yeah, and I've been okay with, I love not having administrative issues.
Right.
I'm feeling good about it.
Well, and you've been retired for 7 years, so.
Yeah, and we moved here last year. I write for the Norwegian American. I do his cultural and heritage type things.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
So yeah, you're still doing things.
Yeah, and then, but we also, I do go to the gym here 5 days a week. I try to keep myself up because I don't want to become a feeble 80-year-old, and I got some health issues. So, and I have more, I have to finish a report on Guam, then I go back to writing stuff. I have a good relationship with the resource manager, John Lafitte.
Oh, in New Orleans?
Yeah. I had one with the cultural resource person, but I don't know the current one, and he's the guy I deal with. But I have a write-up of an 18th century house testing. It's only testing, and then another test that I didn't get to write up. Then I'll be near done with that. I can't believe how much I did then.
Yeah.
it's like endless.
Wow.
But that's what informed me about. And Jim Bradford, who was the regional archaeologist, just wrote me a Christmas card, and he said, I'm still working on my reports. And Sandy got him to finish. She took my example and made him finish. Maybe he was the Elmora one, wasn't Bruce. Bruce had something else. But it was, and so he got that done because she got him to do it because she said, well, Ted got that other thing done, and why can't you get this done?
It's the never-ending saga of archaeology that you never get the reports done.
Yeah, so that's where I came with the premise for Skagway, and I'm right. most happy with it. I feel good about that place.
Yeah.
And I discharged the debt that I said I would do for Samantha. I've done my duty.
Right. There you go.
So that's...
All right. Anything else?
No.
About Skagway or Klondike?
No. I've repeated myself, so...
Okay. Well, we will end it.